Thank you very much for the invitation and the chance to talk to you today. As I announced, I will talk about citation, and I will just show you some evolution of how we try to understand this problem numerically. And first, I will give you an introduction, which is a little childish, maybe. I'm sorry, I'll go fast. So let me introduce my collaborators. So these guys, Murilo and José Suarez, come from Brazil. Nuno is my postdoc, he's Portuguese. And then these three are PhD students, Marcus Vinicius, Thomas Pitz, and Eric Partelli, who's now in Erlangen. And finally, Kate Rasmussen is going to be here next week. So you will hear more about that from him. So, of course, citation is a phenomenon that occurs in turbulent flow. And as there are many participants here, you know that particles in turbulent flow have many applications, and other applications besides turbulence are listed here below, like fluidized beds, pneumatic transport, mixing, etc. So I'd like to show in the beginning of this movie, just because it's quite impressive, of what this means. What is this turbulent transport of particles? This is, as you can see, a sandstorm, and it shows the phenomenon on a large scale. So briefly, what is the theoretical question? We have the Navier-Stokes equation, incompressible, which you know, of course, very well. And we stay in the regime of high Reynolds numbers. Reynolds number, as you know, is defined like this. And so we are in the turbulent regime. So I will call the kinetic viscosity as mu and the dynamic viscosity as eta. So the problem consists in calculating now the drag of a particle in this turbulent flow. So what you have is, in the simplest case, you have, of course, let's say one spherical particle, and on the surface of the particle we have no slip conditions. And so the whole story is a moving boundary problem, because the particle moves, and so the boundary moves. And so the field, the velocity field of the fluid, has to be calculated each time the particle moves a little bit. So the drag force is calculated as the force integrated over the surface of the particle, of the stress tensor of the fluid, and the stress tensor of the fluid is well known, having this diagonal part and then this part, which only acts when the particle is moving. Good. So this can be calculated analytically in the case of the limit of zero Reynolds number. This is known, the Stokes law. And then in the case of turbulence, we have this general drag law. So the drag force is given by this prefactor, which then is multiplied by the square of the velocity and the drag coefficient. And the drag coefficient depends on this, on the velocity, on the, as the Reynolds number, like this. So this is also a very famous picture. And of course, the detailed shape of this function depends on the shape of the object, etc. And I will use in my talk various numerical or empirical approximations of this kind of function. Finally, this is not the full story. Of course, then you have also particle lift forces, which I will mention later, which act when there is a gradient, either a pressure gradient or a shear gradient. And then there is a force not acting in the direction of the flow, but perpendicular to the flow. And then exist also other effects, like the Magnus effect, which acts when the particle is rotating. So all this was a very fast, let's say, introduction. I imagine that everybody knows this already. So what I'm trying to deal with, of course, is not just the motion of one particle, but of many particles. So this is, if you want, numerically, a very demanding task. And for the case of citation, it is not solvable in its full beauty. And so I will go now and show you a sequence of numerical and, yes, approximations that we have been able, forced to do. So the Aeolian transport, the transport of particles by wind, has a lot of consequences, as discussed in this meeting already, on the geomorphological scale. It has a motion of large quantities of sand. And I show you now some movies. So this is a typical citation phenomenon. on a huge dune in Brazil, for instance, you see that dissertation acts like a sheet of sand that floats over, seems to float, or 10 centimeters or 5 centimeters above ground. I show you another movie, which is more, let's say, better to see, because the ground here has a different color. So what you see, dissertation looks like as if the particles are floating, and of course they have a certain time-dependent, motion on top, which comes from the, I will discuss this later, from the intrinsic time fluctuations of turbulence. So what happens in citation is, as the word citation says, you have the jumping of particles. So the word was termed by Bagnold during World War II, and so saltare means to jump. So what we have is that particles, grains, for some reason, they have the chance to come higher, and the wind velocity in turbulent flow increases with height logarithmically. So the higher the particle comes, the more it gets accelerated, and so it gains a lot of energy, kinetic energy. With its energy, it will hit the ground later again, because of gravity, it falls down, and when it hits, it can eject new particles. So this is called the splash. And so you can imagine, that just theoretically, that you have one particle by chance, there's a small eddy that pulls this particle up, it hits the ground, it produces a splash, makes two particles. This is the classical picture. These two particles, each of them produces two particles, so it makes four, and then you have eight, and then you have 16. So you have an exponential growth in the number of trajectories. And of course, this is not possible. At the end of the day, there will be a limitation due to momentum conservation. So I will discuss this also later. So anyway, this phenomenon is known since 60, 70 years. And there have been a lot of experiments in wind tunnels on this transport phenomenon. And what is known is that on Earth, on the, let's say, wind strength on Earth, it's only the particles in the range of 100 to 300 micron diameters which follow this saltation trajectories. If the particles are smaller, then they leave by suspension, they go in suspension, and if the particles are larger, then they will not be able to go high, and they will do what is called creep. And then in these are diagrams showing which process acts at which grain size and at which wind velocity, and you see there is a certain region in which you have the phenomenon of saltation. Okay, so far my introduction. And now I would like to show you how, in several steps, starting in 2000 and 2005 or so, we have been trying to understand this phenomenon using numerical techniques. So we did first, this was done in 2006, with these Brazilian professors, simulate a wind channel numerically with a software that is very well known for fluid dynamics, which of course the SD specialists might despise, which is called Fluent, using the simple K epsilon module of Fluent. You see, we start simple. Different advantage of Fluent is that you have a rather easy full two or three dimensional simulation of the fluid flow, but you have limitations in what concerns the particles. So what we did is the following. We have a channel. The input of the channel is a logarithmic velocity profile. And on the top, we have a wall that moves with the same velocity as the top velocity of this profile, so that it mimics the infinite system. And then we have in Fluent, this is the limitation of Fluent, we must impose the trajectory of the particle. So the Fluent doesn't simulate the particles, it simulates just the trajectories. And these trajectories have a certain mass. So it's not that they have individual particles, it's just you attach to the trajectory a mass, so you impose the ejection angle. So this is the only free parameter, or there are two free parameters, the ejection angle and the mass of the trajectory. But the advantage is that this software then calculates also automatically the feedback of the particles on the fluid. So you have the full, let's say, full fluid motion, but you have no control about over the trajectories or the ejection of particles at the splash. So you just have to suppose that there are as many particles ejected as they arrive here. So the mass of the trajectory stays the same. So that's the, I mean, I tell you just here what are the simplifications, step by step, and then you have to see what you believe or what you don't believe. Yes.
So you prescribe the trajectories of the particles a priori. They are not being calculated by the program. So that means you take a number of particles, you give them some random initial location, and then you assume certain trajectories from there on?
The shape of the trajectory is given, is calculated, but for a given ejection angle. So I know I can, of course, by integrating up over the existing velocity field, I can calculate the trajectory shape, but I cannot, let's say, I've known the phenomenon of the splash. And I don't have individual particles, I just have a massive trajectory.
Yeah. So you say the ejection angle is the only quantity that you need to prescribe?
I need to prescribe, yes.
What about the velocity with which the particle bounces off the wall? How is that determined?
This one is essentially given by the conservation at this point of momentum, exactly.
For example, momentum.
Yes, conserve momentum at this point. So you can calculate with the, of course, by there is a certain error because you have a change in the angle. Yes.
Once the particles are ejected, they're essentially following the fluid velocity superimposed with a constant centering speed.
Exactly. So you calculate these stretched trajectories by so just superposition of two forces. It's really easy because you can separate the components.
You said that the particles change the flow, or flow remains.
Yeah, they change the flow. I will show. I mean, the feedback of the particles on the momentum loss at each height is calculated in the program, and you get the velocity profile, the modified velocity profile. Which I'll show in a minute. Yes, in some sense, no. There is a, let me say, the loss of energy.
Where you've drawn it, there's an increase of energy.
No.
Are there coefficients of restitution associated with that collision?
No. This is not a real collision. It's just you fix.
I don't think so.
No, that's not right. Let me think again. There is a calculation at this point about the new velocity. And this calculation, of course, you can, if you want, impose a certain loss of energy there. Yes.
If you're conserving momentum in both directions, the reflection of the wall would be specular, presumably.
That's right. So you consider only the part of the component of momentum which is perpendicular to the wall. So you know that the angles must be different, of course. Yes.
It's not speculative. It's a rough bet. Yeah. The horizontal momentum is converted to vertical momentum.
Okay.
So this is certainly a rough approximation. This part is not taken well care of. I will do this later better. Okay. Good, so doing this now, you can find out which is the saturated flux by finding out when these trajectories, because since if you have here, you have always a bounce back, and the velocity depends on how much they have gained energy on the way back. If you have a part, maybe I should say this before. So just because I forgot to make clear that the velocity profile is given in this way, since Prandtl, and this defines two constants or three constants. This is the so-called roughness length, which is known since a long time to be about, let's say, one thirtieth of the diameter of the particles. And this is the von Karman constant. And then this prefactor U star is what I will use all the time to define the velocity of the wind. Yes.
So this is the parameter I use for the engine.
Good. So now let me show you what happens if my trajectories are too massive. Then, if they are, if I have more particles than the fluid is able to carry, then I start with one large jump, but then at the next time the fluid is unable to carry sufficiently, and the energy it will have to, in the next step is smaller and smaller and smaller. So the particle at some point falls down, the trajectory goes down. If the trajectory has not enough mass, too little mass, then it will increase in jumps. And so what I can do is I can just tune to find what is the mass I have to give to a trajectory so that it will reach a steady state. And that mass corresponds to the saturated flux. So this is the way I obtain the saturated flux with this method. Okay?
So what do you exactly mean by mass of the trajectory? Is it referring to the density of the particle?
There is no particle. The trajectory is just, you see, the program doesn't simulate individual particles.
Right.
It just says that this is as if there would be a particle of a certain mass. So there's like a stream of mass. It could be many small particles, well, some is the mass, or it could be one particle of one mass, so this doesn't matter. It's just a certain mass attached to the trajectory.
Does that mean that it's like a concentration of particles?
You can see it like that. So it's like a stream of particles that follow these trajectories. Of course, this is completely wrong in reality, because in reality, particles have very different trajectories. So here they are forced all to be on the same trajectory.
But you can also think of it as a number of trajectories.
You can think a lot of parallel trajectories of having all some small mass, but the total mass is given by this number.
But then as the particles move around, as you mentioned, you calculate the effect back on the flow field, and that means your velocity profile of the fluid will change, right?
Yes.
Yes, and that means again there will be an effect on the trajectories of the particles. So
that's right, exactly. Yes. That's exactly what it does. Yes.
But will there be an effect on the number of trajectories?
No. This is the problem. I fixed the number of fixed the mass.
Okay.
That's why it blows up if I have too little mass. And here, just show again, this is a drag law that I use. So I have a drag force and I have a gravity.
And this is all in 2D?
This is in 2D, yes. You can do it in 3D, but I show you 2D data here. Yeah.
Don't you have to fix somehow, say, what the mass of one part, or the diameter of and the mass of one particle are?
Yes.
I mean, the saltation trajectory will depend on how much momentum the particle will pick up from the flow, and that in turn depends on the diameter of the particle and its mass.
That's correct, but this is not, you see,
talk about the number density or the concentration of particles to make that consistent.
The drag force would depend on the rate of the particles, but in this program this is a built-in unit of fluent. You just have a fixed number as a drag coefficient, and it's independent, it's just attached to the trajectory. So, I mean, what you say is all correct, and I come back later to a better calculation. I show you just what this gives. This is like the first attempt, yes, to see what comes up. And so there, once you find the right mass, then you have the saturated flux. So we can obtain in this way the saturated flux as function of the wind strength of U star. And this is what I'll show you next, yes.
We had a discussion yesterday about the saturation length. So if I look at this plot here, then the saturation length is of the order of hundreds of meters per year.
In that case, yeah, it depends on the wind velocity, yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
It depends on the wind velocity, not on the density ratio.
Well, that's true.
It depends on everything a little bit. I mean, this is not constant.
Yesterday we were talking about the density ratio of the diameter of the particle.
Yeah, this is a very approximate formula from Andreotti. But if you make the simulation, you will see it's not like perfectly like this. There's always some change. Depends on everything a little bit. Sorry. Okay, so that's what you find. you find that there exists, this is now a new star, you find that there exists a threshold, as you expect, below which there is no transport, and then you see that for large velocities, new star, you have a law that goes like u star cube, which is known since Bangalore, since 41. So this is known from this, it can be easily obtained from dimensional analysis. And then the question is what happens here in this region in between. There have been about 15 different empirical relations in literature, all obtained in wind channels. So one of them is the one by Lettau and Lettau, which is very widely used. We saw yesterday in the talk by Alexander that he took here two different powers, alpha and beta. So in the case of Lettau and Lettau, this is 2 and 1. And what we now find, here you see the dashed line, this is Lettau and Lettau. And what we find here is that you can better approximate the data if you assume that the law starts like a pure parabolic law. So then you see that Lettau is cubic everywhere, and we see that even a certain deviation. So we can get very nice straight line in the log problem, which it doesn't mean that this result is perfect because we have done some approximations. This is just what we find using this approximation, but at least we are able to reproduce the fact that there is a threshold and all these kind of phenomenological things. Then we can look at the velocity profile. We see now how much the velocity profile that carries particles is modified with respect to the pure logarithmic one. So this is the loss in momentum as function of the height. This is the height. This is here the unperturbed minus the perturbed profile for different q's at a fixed value of u star. So we just change the flux and see how much how much momentum we lose. What you see is these curves can all be collapsed in a single curve by dividing by the flux. So this is fine. And now we can do the same thing by looking just at the saturated flux for different u stars. So this is what I show you here. So this is the velocity profile, the relative velocity profile for different values of u star. And what you see is that now you cannot collapse them. They have they go to a joint common point, which could be maybe the final focus. But anyway, what you see is that the maximum, there's always a maximum, a position, a height at which you have a maximum loss of momentum.
Yes. Well, what is the magnitude of ux0, which is the unperturbed value for
it is the logarithmic one that I showed you before. So this
what will be that?
I take precisely this one. And from there, yes?
But I just wanted to get a magnitude of in meters per second, what that would be, possibly wrong.
Oh, here's something like
5 meters per second, 10 meters.
Between 5 and 10 meters.
Yeah.
Per second.
So because I wanted to see this is 10% variation or something like that.
So what you see is that there is a particular height at which you have a maximum loss of momentum, which is clear because the trajectories, they will have a certain, at the point at which there's a turning point of the trajectory, they will have a larger, let's say, presence at a certain height. And this is, of course, very pronounced here because we are forcing all trajectories to be equal by construction. So what you see is that, of course, then if you increase u star, the trajectories increase in height, and so also the height at which you lose most momentum increases. So you see this, and if you plot now the maximum height, as function of u star, then you find, then you find that as this is the maximum height as function of u star, this is a linear increase that goes to zero at the threshold. So that the, if you look at the, remember the movie at which you had a floating layer that looked like floating over a certain height on the ground, this, the height of this floating layer is going to increase proportionally to u minus u star. Yes, sir.
Is that exactly or almost exactly the saltation.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Saltation length is not, this is the saltation height. This is essentially, yeah, the saltation height. Not exactly, but very close. Okay, so far this first calculation was, yes?
But the fact that saltation height increased with the wind speed is not governed by the collision law we take at the surface at the bed?
No, because this is for all calculations the same. So for fixed collision rule at the ground, and actually,
what would be the difference if you simulate transport on a rigid bed on an erodible bed? So I cannot see the difference.
Oh, no. You see, everything I say is within the model. So I have no erodible bed, I have a rigid bed. I just have now, in discussing the model in which I have these fixed trajectories, which have a certain rebouncing, and with a constant angle of rebouncing. And of course we change the angle, and so that the result qualitatively is the same.
So it's but more transport of a rigid bed.
It's a rigid bed. What do you mean different? I mean, it's the model I discussed. I have here trajectories which jump, trajectories that jump on a certain flat surface. The surface is not modified by the jumping. And at the saturated flux, all the jumping is the same. So this gives you well-defined height because they all jump the same way. It's a simplified model. So I mean, the model gives what it is worth. I mean, you cannot get out more of it. And there, as I said, the angle of ejection is a parameter I can change. And so we did this, of course, for different angle of ejection and also different, let's say, rebouncing details. And it gives qualitatively always the same result. But the slope, let's say, of this curve changes a little bit.
If the restitution and if the energy loss in the collisions was a function of the impact velocity, then this might change quite a lot.
Maybe, yes. At least we haven't tried. But then you have to, of course, say how it should depend. Yeah. And then again, it's better to do it, you'll see later, better to do it really. If you do really colliding particles, then you have a real splash, and then things look more realistic. We'll discuss this maybe. Okay, but so far this model is on Earth and reproduces the threshold and reproduces the fact that you have a floating layer at a certain height, which increases in height as function of U star. Good. So next step we did is to study the same thing on Mars. The same model, but now going on Mars conditions to see what changes. So this was the work of Eric Paquet. By the way, he did his PhD thesis on Mars, about Mars. And not on Mars, about Mars. And I took him to some excursions and to dune fields in Brazil. And once he came back to see his mother, who was very dirty and very worn down, the mother called me and said, "Professor, please don't send my son to Mars." True story. So what we did is we took all parameters from the model and changed them to Mars conditions. So you see gravity goes to 1/3, and then this is the most important change, is the density of the fluid, yes, of the air, whatever, it goes to a very, very small value. And then the size of the grain, this is something we have from these missions, so we have an idea that the size of the grain is about 3 times larger. Okay, so this of course we don't know, this value, this will get out later. And the viscosity is not so different. So the kinematic viscosity is very different. This is what makes up the big difference between these two phenomena. So anyway, we did the simulation and find the same effect. We find again that there is a function U star is a threshold, and that the saturated flux increases with a law which can be approximated by where a parabolic behavior at the origin. So here you compare this on Earth, and this was Mars. Of course, the values at which you have this phenomenon are much higher. So you see that U star here is about 0 point something, and here was 1.2, so in much, much higher values. Okay, so here this is just another of the many empirical formulas that are used to approximate these behaviors, so let me try another one.
Could you clarify why the wind speed seems to be greater on Mars?
The wind speed, sorry?
You quoted a wind velocity that seemed to be a factor of 10 higher.
Yes.
And that seems surprising because, there's less solar energy driving the atmosphere, and I think the day length on Mars is considerably longer. So it's not clear why the wind velocity should be greater.
Well, that's what people that study Mars say, that the wind velocity is much higher. Uh-huh. But only it's small time, so are these storms. Uh-huh. So what makes the really, normally Mars does not move. It does nothing happen. The rains don't move. Yeah. But then once in a while, let's say once a year, you have a strong storm. Mm-hmm. This is what makes the rotation of Mars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I'm not a specialist on Mars. I mean, this is what people that find it, observe Mars and do study. Good. So here I show you now the attempt to get all these data from Mars and Earth on a common plot. So what we find is, it's just empirical playing around, that if I divide the saturated flux by this expression, then I can collapse the Earth and the Mars data on a single line. And interestingly, the velocity that is given by square root of g times d, which is what typically people use it to normalize velocities, are more or less equal for Mars and for Earth. So these cannot be used at all in these scaling relations. So that's of course an empirical, let's say, observation. And then we studied the saltation trajectories. And we find that the saltation trajectories, this is these curves here correspond to the height of the trajectories, and this is the length of the trajectory for Earth, and this is the height of the trajectory of Mars, and the length of the trajectories on Mars. So you see, first of all, that the lengths and the heights on Mars are about 20 times larger than on Earth. So they're huge. This is actually why all these wind channels for Mars don't work, because you need huge channels. And then you see that you can now normalize these lengths by this factor. So the factor mu times g squared and then the third root, because they have units of time. And so you see that these lengths and height, they can scale this way linearly in u star minus ut. So when you go to small u star minus ut, star t. So at the end, you can rescale the length and the height of both Mars and Earth by dividing through a characteristic length, which is given by this expression. So here you see all the data now for length and height as function of u star minus ut on Earth and on Mars. Yes?
The length on Earth, and I'm sorry, the height, were less than a meter.
Yeah, 10 centimeters.
It's a different mechanism for the dust storms, which are...
Yeah, the dust storms. And this first movie I showed is cheating because there's no suspension, of course, in the real dust storms. The citation is... But the movie I showed was misleading. It was, the real citation phenomenon is something that happens a few, let's say, not more than 50 centimeters above ground. Yeah.
And there is no dependence of the grain diameter?
Not in this model.
No.
What is the model?
Not really, no.
Do people know what the grain diameters on Mars would be? Yeah.
Well, this is what these missions that they have measured, and they say they are about 600 micron diameters. So they're larger than Earth. Mm-hmm. But of course, this is a very local measurement also, so a lot of uncertainty.
I cannot understand why there is no dependence on the grain diameter, because if the grain diameter changes, the drag force are different.
But the grain diameter enters here. Here is the grain diameter.
Okay.
there comes in. So in the flux it enters. Okay, so this is now also the this is now the ratio between length and height, which is shown here. The Earth and Mars, and this is the impact impact angle. So this sorry, this is the impact angle, this is the ratio between length and height from Mars and Earth. And they also can be rescaled by some rescaling law. And finally, you can obtain from this the eventual velocity of dunes on Earth and on Mars, because you know it depending, of course, on the size of the dune. So we know that the size, the velocity of the dune is inversely proportional to the height. This has been well. You laugh.
The length. Anyway, the height is proportional. I spent quarter of an hour to explain it.
Yeah, I know, but
the length and not one over height, but nobody cares. I know.
Because the only person because if
who insists on this then.
Well, let me say like this: in the normal case, if the crest is not behind the maximum, then the length and the height are proportional to each other. I can show you data.
Well, for a very large dune, the length and the height scale with each other. Yes. And then it doesn't matter what you say. There's one over length. Anyway. That's a very funny thing, that in the whole community, everybody says one over height. Even Alex said it yesterday.
Yeah, I
see. That is just like this.
But yeah,
anyway,
roughly the height of a lot of plot.
The length is not any more difficult than the height.
Well, but you anyway, remember, I mean, we measured in Mauritania.
Yes.
A lot of dunes and collapse them on top of each other and have beautiful scaling length against height, and they go linear to each other. So, in practical terms, I believe. Okay, so that's the whole story about the fluent calculations. And so, they are worth what they are worth. I know that a real fluid mechanics person doesn't like that very much. But so, if there are any questions, maybe I can continue. I can do them now, otherwise I continue with different calculations. So, okay. So now, next, this is now work that was done later, this was much later. These two guys, some of you have seen them, these are both my PhD students. He finished his law professor in China, he went from a PhD directly to become professor. I don't know how he did this. Anyway, so now what we do is we use this discrete element model. It means we simulate the trajectories of the particles by solving Newton's equation in the fluid. But doing this has this advantage that you cannot anymore solve for the full three-dimensional fluid velocity field. This is numerically impossible. I mean, you have many particles that are turbulent in a three-dimensional fluid velocity field. This you cannot do that calculation yet. So we have to simplify now on the other side, on the side of the fluid calculation. We have discussions on that side. We have always some kind of approximation. Okay, so what we do is we consider spherical particles. This is a simple, and we have now again a channel, and we have inelastic collisions between particles, between particles and the walls of the channel too. And finally, we have to trigger the phenomenon so that we let the particles fall down at the beginning. It's done in the real wind tunnels by feeding, so that we have seen this yesterday also, and you throw in some particles, so of course this gives some starting for the phenomenon of saltation. Okay, so here you go, we have again our velocity profile, and now you see here my particle bed. On top I have a wall which is fixed, but very, very high, so high that the particles will never touch them, so we put them really, very high. And the particle bed has a depth of about 10 to 15 layers, and the dissipation with the boundary wall, the bottom wall, is very high. So the restitution coefficient is 0.3 or something like that, 0.2, in order to dampen waves. You don't want them that we don't have this reflection of elastic waves that particles will jump up just because they're reflected in the body. So the restitution coefficient otherwise is about 0.7, which is correct for sand. Okay, now we impose again this logarithmic velocity profile with a certain offset H0. H0 is the where it starts, the beginning here. But we have to calculate this position because now the surface is not anymore flat. The surface is going to be rugged, and we have to adapt the position of the velocity profile to this to the surface. Okay, so the most of the particles is given, as I said, by the classical discrete elements. So we have three terms. We have the drag force, the collision between particles or between particles in water, and the gravity. And the drag force is, as before, given by the square of the relative velocities between fluid and particle, and by the drag coefficient. And I use here a relation by Cheng, empirical relation of the drag coefficient as function of the velocity. Okay. Now the collision between particles contains two parts. It's elastic, so this delta here is just how much the particles are squeezed against each other, the overlap of these particles you want. So this is the radius, the two radii of the two particles. So the particles are not of the same size, but there is a distance is Gaussian, and the sigma, the variance, is 1.5. 0.15 is 15%, sorry. So this is the amount of, let's say, of how much the particles are deformed. And this k here is the elastic modulus. And then on top, we have dissipation, which is given here in a viscous form. But one can show that then if we do it this way, this is the deformation rate, then the Cn can be related in a one-to-one relation to the restitution coefficient. And the relation I will not derive, but you can show that if you have a linear law, not Hertzian law, it's linear law, then you have this relation to restitution coefficient and this damping coefficient Cn.
So then this is simulating the motion of all of the particles in that layer in the bottom.
Yeah, obviously.
Because they bounce against each other extremely rapidly.
Yeah, this is done. So they are the most all particles in the system, they follow exactly the same law. Mm-hmm. Yes. Good. So as I said, use En equals 0. So if now, first, if I have no feedback, suppose I just impose the logarithmic velocity profile, we can do that from playing around, no feedback, then we find that indeed the flux, we get a flux, we get particles jumping, I show you some movies later, that the flux is 0 up to a certain threshold. This threshold is quite far away, you have to see there's a 3 here. So the threshold is 0.3, which is much higher than what you expect. Because there's no feedback, so of course there's much more force dragging the particles. And then what you find is, interestingly, now a jump at the threshold, and then you get here the saturated flux. So this is somehow different from what I showed you before. There's a jump.
How do you start this process?
We start, as I said, we show that move also, but we throw the particles in, some particles in. So there's a bed. And we throw some particles in, and these particles initiate the motion. Yes. Later I show you other tricks, but this is what we do now. Yes.
If I understand correctly, you do not have any, you assume the profile of a turbulent flow,
yes.
But you do not take into account any fluctuations in the flow itself.
Up to now, in this simulation, first attempt, I just fix the velocity profile everywhere, homogeneous, with a height dependence, and then it means you have a well-defined, every height you have a well-defined drag force, and you calculate this, and this is very easy. Okay? Now we have to introduce the feedback in some way. And this is, if you want, something which will again probably lead to some discussion, because of course we have to do some kind of approximation. Okay, so what we do is we say that there is a loss of momentum at each height. So we divide now the height in layers. The width of the height of one layer is about 1.3 diameters of a particle. So we really, really fine layers. These layers become bigger when we go up. Later when we go very high, we have a huge layer. So we have a kind of a grading in the size of these layers. And in each layer, we have a certain number of particles flying at a given time. And so the fluid exerts a drag force on these particles. These drag forces I call here Fi. So Fi are the forces that are exerted on the particles by the fluid in a layer at a certain height. And what I now do is, this is now the size of such a layer. This is first in 2D, later I show you 3D. But in 2D, you can imagine the area of one of these layers, the area A. And so this is, if you want, the relative stress, the stress that in this layer is exerted by the particles on the fluid. And so this is a new discrete way I obtain this, and this corresponds now to, if I sum it up over all layers from Z to infinity, this corresponds to the overall drag that is given by the upper layer on this lower layer. So this I call here tau G, is the grain stress exerted at layer Z.
Is that due to the wakes being shed from the grains because the fluid's moving slightly faster? What physically?
Yes. I mean, the drag force contains always the difference. The difference between the velocity locally and the fluid. Yes, that's exactly.
So this is always updated as a function of time, right?
Exactly. Each time step, yeah. I have to do that.
Right. But you average over the entire horizontal
space. That's exact. This is the big approximation I do. So I do it if all particles in the same layer exert on the profile the same kind of. This is. I know this is dirty because of course it does not take into account that there are different positions. There are more or less particles. Yes. So I'm sorry. This is my opinion. And but it has to be computationally feasible at the end, what I do. I will show you later movies in 3D, etc. Okay, so then from knowing now the grain stress, I can then obtain also the shear velocity in the layer UZ. And now in order to obtain the full profile, what I do is I integrate from bottom up. And so I have to, of course, know where is the bottom. So what is this h0? And so what I do is, I say that at h, that if the stress is less than 0.1 times, if the velocity of the fluid would be less than 0 times 1 times u star, then it is below the point at which the velocity profile starts. So, of course, I start from very low, from here, and I see, of course, here there is no velocity, I go up, 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 and when the velocity is larger than 0.1 times u star, then I say, okay, this is my h0, from there on, I start to integrate upwards. And this is important because the surface is rugged, and so, I mean, this 0.1 we found out just from empirically comparing to real profiles. So just finding out that this is a good number to start, because of course sometimes the surface is above and sometimes it is below this h0. Yeah? So by integrating upwards, we integrate, in fact, this equation upwards now in Z. Yes?
You're talking about time-varying situation. Right?
Yes, each time step I do this.
When you do this, how do you take into account the inertia of the flow, of the fluid?
Inertia of the fluid?
Something of changes in the in the particle layers locally, say at x, then the fluid has to adjust itself. You do it basically without any delay.
That's right.
I think probably your mass loading is not
very
high that you can completely neglect the fluid.
I do that. So I do my fluid adapts instantaneously to the new situation.
So in the steady state balance.
In some sense, I assume that the fluid adapts much faster than the motion of the particles. This is an assumption. Okay, this is what it is. I mean, I tell you honestly what I do. Now you can judge if you like it or not. Sorry. No. So anyway, we get at each time step, we get now a modified velocity profile, which then acts, of course, on the particles. And so at the end, we have some kind of a flow diagram, which has a wind profile. We calculate the forces that act, and we calculate the grain stress. We integrate up this profile. Then we look if there is a, let's say, a change between we integrate up until we see there is no more change, and then of course we stop integrating. Okay. And if this is true, then my most dangerous part is over. I was afraid that you would criticize this very much. Now I show you just some So this is now for instance, how it looks like when you take U star equals 0.52. First, I show you two-dimensional results. So here, the colors of the particles just show that they are, they have no meaning. I take two different colors to be able to see better what's going on. And here is another. Yeah?
This is a two-dimensional.
This is 2D. This is 2D. First of all, 2D. And here I show you another. This is a higher velocity, same thing, but a stronger wind field. Okay. But now the results. So first of all, we can change, of course, many things. There are a lot of parameters and can play around. So I can change the restitution coefficient. And what you see, this is the saturated flux, the function of U star. For some historical reasons, I have already this screen because there was an error in the translation. We had to take it correct. So anyway, what you see now is that the jump occurs at about 0.15, which is okay, which numbers are okay, in meters per second, and you see that there is a jump. So clearly, the jump that I showed you without feedback survives also in the case with feedback. And that is different from what has been, let's say, seen up to now. And you see that there is, of course, a dependence on the restitution coefficient. So that if I put less energy dissipation, then I have an earlier onset, which is, of course, imagined because then the trajectories jump higher. Makes sense.
Why is there a jump? Not just jump and slope.
No, that's what I'm saying. There is a jump. There is a jump. These are data. These are the data we obtain. So we observe that at the threshold there is a jump.
So there's a minimum.
I will discuss the jump more now. I mean, this is one of the interesting findings of this model, or maybe, I mean, actually, we have also seen it in experiments later. I show you, talking about experiments did with Kent, you will see the jump again. Yes, so maybe here.
Am I seeing that correctly? So if the restitution coefficient is 80%, you get.
Oh, this is wrong. No, this is wrong. Blue one is here. This is, sorry, this must be wrong. This is red here. This is red. Thank you. Yes.
The flux is that the fractional volume flux of the particles compared to the fluid, or how can we interpret this?
The flux is always the number of particles that go by in one time unit through one area unit. This flux is not, it goes through the entire system. How many particles go per, because it's 2D. So 2D is just how many particles pass in 1 second a certain line.
Is it how many particles? Because then you need to say something about the size. Is it number of particles or volume fraction?
It's not number of particles. It's the mass of all the particles mass together. Yes. Particles is kilogram. The unit is kilogram per second and per meter.
It's the horizontal momentum divided by the length.
You can see that way, yeah. You can see that way. No. Hmm? You had a question.
Mine was the same as Dieter's.
Okay.
I understood that you are taking into account the particles effect in the mean flow and the inflow drive. But are you taking into account the effect of the particles in the turbulence?
What do you mean exactly?
So I would assume that if you have turbulence and you have a particle, mm-hmm. it's changing momentum with the turbulence, it will reduce the amount of turbulence in the fluid.
I'm conserving momentum. This is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And then I feel safe. Now, I don't know what you mean by...
I think the question is, do the particles influence the turbulent velocity fluctuations?
Oh, this is fluctuations, this is something that will come later. I will discuss the fluctuations. Up to now, it is this. I'm only talking about the average velocity of the turbulent flow. Yes, so there is no time-dependent component, no fluctuating component in the velocity of the turbulent flow. Okay? So this is what is typically what you mean when you say you have a logarithmic profile. Logarithmic profile is just the average, not more. Yeah. But I will come to the other point also later.
Sorry, can I just a curiosity? So you showed before in the the simulation that when you increase the velocity, it seems to me that close to the bed there is a higher concentration, and I'm wondering. Is your drug force sensitive to the idea that there are more particles surrounding a typical particle? Yes. So it depends on the concentration.
Then the fluid velocity is reduced, and then the drag force is reduced. Yes, but I don't see what you say, because when I mean, the number of, but it's no moving here. What do you mean?
When you did 82,
yes,
then you increased 82.
Yes.
Well, yeah. I had said close to the bed, the concentration was of particles. I thought, you know, the drag force was simply as an isolated particles in the flow.
No. I will show you later its profile of concentration as function of height, and we'll see how the things are on the velocity.
Looks to me if I'm the particles are moving from right to left on the bottom. Is that
this is maybe optical effect.
They are moving at the bottom.
They are moving because they are dragged, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. But they are not all moving to the right.
Yeah. In this simulation, the height to which the particle moves is basically ballistic from the initial condition.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's discuss how much. Okay.
Because you don't have a lift force.
And no, exactly.
Your flow is on the horizontal direction.
Correct.
So it's ballistic in that sense. So purely is a function of initial vertical momentum and the drag it feels in the vertical direction, sort of like it goes up.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I just want to clarify.
The conservation momentum is most dependent. Okay, so this is the jump that we have seen. You've seen fine again. So the jump survives. And I show you also here some other, there's a jump, and you saw here also comparison with different radical curves, and you always have this jump. So the jump is now is there. Okay, now let's look in more detail what happens. So here you see the curve not close to the threshold, but for large you start, so the threshold is somewhere here. The jump is very small, you don't see it anymore. And now you see that the overall behavior of the saturated flux as function of the U star, or I go now also for elegance to dimensionless units, so I define the Shields number, which is the dimensional, non-dimensional way of the U star. It's given by U star squared divided by G by the average diameter of the particles, and then divided by the ratio of the densities minus 1. So this is what is called the Sheets number. This is equivalent to U star, but in non-dimensional way. So if you start, if the threshold was at 0.14, then the threshold in terms of the Shields number will be 0.08. And so what you see now as a function of this Shields number is that our saturated flux agrees very well with the formulas here of, this is the formula of theta and letta, so it's asymptotically goes as expected, like theta to the 3/2. And the experiments that you see here, this is how the experiment looks like, are ones from Iversen and Kjell Rasmussen from about 15 years ago. And you see the classical problem is that there is a lot of scatter. Experimentally, we have this issue. Then now, here I show you, interestingly, that when you, this is the question of how the because I remember you, I start with some feeding, so I throw particles in, and I can ask the question, how long does it take until all the particles I have thrown in come to rest? And I'm below the threshold. So below the threshold, there's no flux in the steady state. So the initial disturbance should die out. And it dies out in a certain characteristic time, which I call here the transient time. And what you see is that this transient time diverges when you approach the threshold from below. So you see here, when you are very, very small velocities, then you throw in the particles immediately and they stop. And when you throw, when you have increased the wind velocity, then it takes longer until every particle comes to rest. And of course, once you are below, above this threshold, then this, they never come to rest, because then you have the steady state flux. Okay, then also I should mention that one can also dimensionalize the flux. This is the way to make an a-dimensional flux. This is also classically in this field. And this is the value of the threshold, 0.048. This is the value which is actually very close to the experimental value. And now I want to show you the next thing we tried, namely to say, what about if during the steady state flow, we add some perturbations? Because now, come back to your question, we have no lift. We have no, I mean, we just have a conservation of the momentum in the horizontal, in the vertical direction. So how can we actually start the process? Because now I've been starting the process by throwing in some particles, which is, of course, fake. In reality, that doesn't happen. And so we included now two ways of adding a perturbation. And these two ways are, one, to add a lift force, and the other, to add random forces, just to see what happens, because we're playing around. So the lift forces, as you remember, I showed in the beginning, they are given in a similar way as the drag forces, except that here we have now not the velocity, but the gradient velocity, it's square. And there is also an empirical parameter called the lift coefficient. And this has been shown by Chappell to be roughly related to the drag coefficient, so it's more or less a constant number. So what we now do is we just apply to the particles that are close to the surface this extra force. And then, of course, the particles become somehow lighter. And how light they become will depend on the gradient of the velocity field. So there's a coupling to the fluid field. And so there's an extra kind of way of particles to rise. And this is another way we do it. Just randomly, this is the most brute force. We just say every second, we choose a certain fraction of particles, which we leave up by one diameter, which makes that they come now in the region in which there is a certain velocity, and then they can be dragged away. So this is all just testing. And no, what you find is that, you remember, this is blue, this is green. So now we find that if we add this effect, the curve, this is the blue one, and this is the green one, your threshold is shifted to the left. That means you initiate the process earlier. But still you have a jump. But now you have a region here in between the threshold that you get with lift or with initiation and the threshold you get without. And in this region now, we will study this region in more detail we find now hysteresis, we find intermittent behavior. Yes, in this region, I will talk a lot about this region next. Okay? Good. Now, I show you what happened in this region. So this is now in the steady state. This here. This is about 0.048. So this is in the steady state. So you see the flux, the function of time, fluctuates at a certain mean value. And this is now in the intermediate region. So here you see this is now below 0.048. So you see at some point the flux dies. And then it starts again because of lift. So we can initiate the flux from nothing. So we have regions of flux and regions of no flux. Yes.
This randomness is not because of the flow, but because of the particle randomness. So in other words, the flow still remains function of only the vertical direction.
Of course, yes. But I impose the randomness on the computer. I mean, I just say, okay. I choose certain number of particles, I lift them a little bit up randomly.
The reason I ask this is in a flow, you also have randomness coming in from the turbulent velocity flow.
Yes, we come to that point
even
later.
Without that, you have the randomness coming from the random distribution of particles and the random motions.
Yes, a lot of randomness in this whole story. But the random fluctuations, I will discuss also later. So when we come to this point. Okay, so that's what you find. Now, the velocity, this is all that I'm showing you here for the time being is 2D. Let me show you later 3D. So this is now what you have seen before already, but now for this case, the change of the velocity profile, so this is the momentum transfer, if you want, for different values of U star. So again, like before, you see that if you increase, there's always a certain height at which you have a maximum of a momentum loss, and this height increases essentially linearly with theta, or with U star. And it's interesting to see, if you look now at the concentration of particles, this is now the height, and this is the concentration of particles that fly at a certain height. So of course, at low height are more particles, and if you go higher, the less particles. So of course, if you have a stronger wind, like the green one, you have higher particles flying than if you have a black one. So this is all very consistent. Yes.
Just a question to be sure to understand. Theta is a shield parameter?
Theta is a shield parameter, yes. So this is equivalent to U star.
It corresponds to very high shields.
This green one is corresponds to high shields, yes.
At 0.3, 0.5, you see.
That is very high. It does not exist on Earth. It's high. On Earth, the largest you can get is 0.5. So this is beyond what you get on Earth. I mean, on the computer you can do whatever you want.
Yes, sir. So this corresponds to very strong.
Very strong velocity. Okay. Yes.
If you did the same plot in your simple model that you showed at the beginning, would you not have the concentration very high also at the top because the particles spend most of the time at the top?
Well, yes, that's true. But in the other model, of course, this was a trivial thing because we had equal trajectories, all equal size.
This is the effect of having very different trajectories.
Yes, here, I mean, here it's not trivial. Here it's more interesting. I mean, this is not in the other case. I can exactly tell you where they are because I have this trajectory. And interestingly, this is something we observe. I don't know why. Is that the inflection point of this curve corresponds to the height at which you have here the maximum. I don't know if this means anything. Okay, so that's the profile. Now I go to, this is also, you can do another playing around, you can modify, you can renormalize these twin profiles and plot them, and then you find that they all go through in one point. Like I showed you before, there's a point at which they seem to cross. And this is sometimes called the Bagnold focus. Not very useful, but anyway. Okay, so now we go to 3D. So we get all these things I showed you, we can do also in 3D. So this is now a calculation at theta equals 0.15 in 3D, just to show you the color corresponds now to the kinetic energy. It's a logarithmic scale which is linear, but since there are very few particles with very high energy, you only see very few red ones and everybody else seems to be blue. Yes. But now you can see, we'll study more in detail what happens here. This is quite fun. So So the movie is quite long and it's very entertaining.
Before you show to me, you saw a lot of particles in the bottom moving.
Here it's less. Well, two reasons. One is that, of course, here you don't see the moving because there are particles behind its particles. It's completely blue here because there are always the holes. You cannot see holes because there are other particles. But they move, of course, and in 2D I showed you only a section like this, and now it's deeper. So this is why you see it. And now I show you also what happens for different velocities. But this time, I know the color shows here. The red ones are the flying ones. The blue ones are the ones on the bed. And I now visualize the forces that the blue ones and red ones act on the bottom. And you can see the impacts, how the impacts create elastic waves in the bed. And sometimes, and then of course it's interesting to study in detail, as you did this a lot, you know, what each impact happens. And sometimes you have impact in one position, and you have an elastic wave, and then you have an injection somewhere else. So it's not necessarily at the same position. Yes. Okay, so all this is the same model I showed you before.
In a disordered system, you tend to get forces propagating as force chains.
Yes, exactly.
I'm wondering why you don't see that in these simulations.
Oh, yes, you see that. Look, yeah. I mean, this is what I show you here. These are, of course, I don't plot them, but of course, these regions here that light up, they are a network of force chains.
Yeah,
that's exactly this phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And you can then also study in one of these collisions, you can study the displacement of the particles and see how they go or how far it can go such a impact. So that's quite strong.
You chose parameters for the stiffness of the compressibility of the surface of the particles. Mm-hmm. Are those physically realistic, or did you have to choose softer particles?
Softer. They're about one order of magnitude softer than they should be.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry, this is the detail.
And you apply periodic boundary conditions.
Yes, I didn't say this. Yes, exactly.
How deep is it in the scan-wise direction?
It's about 10 particles diameters deep.
That's a silly question, but do you, of the collisions for that dense matrix, do you have three-way collisions too? Or do you take
them down? No. The collisions are binary, okay. But you can have on one particle several binary collisions. One particle can have a binary collision here and a binary collision there.
At the same time?
At the same time.
Okay. So that's the feature of the soft sphere model, because the contacts are sustained for a long time.
Mm. Yes, exactly. If I have event-driven, then I would have only instantaneous collisions. Okay. So we find in 3D now the same phenomenon. We find again that there is a jump. And now, of course, again, this jump depends on the restitution coefficient. So if there is a restitution coefficient of 1, which means completely elastic collisions in the air. So now we have the following situation. We always keep the elasticity restitution coefficient on the ground to be 0.7, so that the particles they don't have the energy conservation is fulfilled. But now we consider that the elastic the collisions in the air can have different restitution coefficients. This is something we'll explore now soon. So here you see if in the air you can collide more, then you get a stronger, in this case. We'll see this later in more detail.
If you turn down the coefficients of restitution further, do you reach a point where there is no saltation?
Exactly, yes.
There's a critical value of the...
With the ground. I mean, this is what I'm saying. I keep on the ground the restitution coefficient always 0.7. Mm-hmm. They will only study what happens up above the ground. This is next investigation. But first, just show you again some images of the time devolution of the flux for different new stars. And you see that, of course, if you are below threshold, then the flux just stops. And then here again in 3D now, the agreement between our simulations, which are these circuits and the experiments and the theoretical curve, in this case, we took the 1/0. Good. And now comes the question of the restitution coefficient. So next study is the study of the mid-air collisions. We want to know which role play these collisions in the air. In particular, we want to know what happens if we have no collisions at all. I mean, if the particles would be transparent to each other. I mean, many people have supposed in calculations that the density of particles in saturation is so low that you can disregard the collisions. It was a very generic kind of assumption many years, many, many people thought this. And so we're going to investigate how important are the collisions of the particles in the air, in the fly. And this is the work we also done here with this guy. So what we did is we did the same calculation now for the case without collisions in the air. So the particles are transparent. Then with collisions with restitution coefficient 1, elastic, and collision with the 0.7. And we found something extremely funny, namely that if I have no collisions, the flux is substantially lower. It's not a small effect. It's a huge effect. I mean, the larger you start, the more important becomes the effect, that the collisions in the air seem to enhance the flux. It seems at first sight even contradictory, because you say collisions in the air should reduce, let's say, the overall capacity of moving. And here we see in this case, it's higher if you have more elasticity. But we saw this in more detail. This is not always the case, yes. So here I now show you, in an overview, what happens if I have three cases. I have different shield numbers, different velocities, and here I have different restitution coefficients in the air. So I vary the restitution coefficient from 0.2 to 1. And what you see is that if I have very strong wind, 0.9, which is beyond what we can do on Earth, interestingly, there is a value of restitution coefficient different from 1 at which the flux is highest. So this is the flux. So the flux seems to depend on the restitution coefficient, and for very low shield number, the dependence of the restitution coefficient is weak, but this arrow here shows always what is the value of the flux if you have no collisions. So you see that putting in collisions increases typically the flux with respect to the case without collisions. And what is particularly weird is that here, for instance, in this case, the flux is higher with dissipation than without dissipation. So you would say, how can this be? I reduce the energy and I increase the flux. So we have to investigate what's going on. And here you see also the concentration profile. This is the height, this is the concentration. The red curve corresponds to the case without collisions, and the yellow one with collisions. And clearly you see that due to collisions, the entire particle bed is higher.
Yes. So this, in this case, you keep the coefficient of restitution on the bed the same, 0.7.
Yes, all the time, yes. On the bed it's 0.7. I only ask, what is the question, role of collisions in fly? You have this cloud of particles flying. Remember in my movie, and I ask, what is the role of the collisions?
Could it be that this, when you include these collisions, you send more particles towards back to the bed so that they can resuspend more?
No. The more the particles go down, the less they are going to be transported, because the velocity of the air increases with height. So what you have to do to increase the flux is to put these particles as high as possible, so that they get a lot of momentum from the air. And that here, this is consistent, because you see, if I have restitution coefficient here in this case, here on this top, here, you see this is the yellow curve, you see that the particles go very high, and that's why they have a lot of flux. That's essentially the opposite. The particles are moved upwards. Yeah? Yeah.
Or isn't there also the other, maybe you're thinking of the effect that a collision can accelerate a particle that is going down, so it will impact with higher velocity and splash out more particles, increasing the flux in this way.
Yeah, but I mean, if you have a collision with two particles, then you can, one particle maybe then going fast in this direction, but the other one goes fast in the opposite direction.
Maybe I said it wrongly. Yes. Like a good physicist, I would change it to fit the answer.
Careful.
So maybe, you see, without mid-air collisions, the only way particles go up is through the lift force, which is dominant close to the bottom because shear is very low up
the
bottom.
Right, yeah.
And then any initial momentum that you give it. But with mid-air collisions, you have a mechanism for some of the particles to gain vertical momentum.
That's exactly. Yes, this is what happens. I mean, you are with collisions, you can make particles move upwards. This is what is going to be the solution of the problem. But now you have not answered to me why it's better to have restitution. We will discuss this too. So here, this is another, the same thing, but for a different value of theta, so we always have the same effect. Good. Now, here, you see the same thing in two dimensions. This first was 3D, in two dimensions, the same effect. So just consider. And here, now I compare 2 and 3D. So okay, this is very specific. We don't need to do so much. Good. Now I show you I want to show you this movie, which kind of illustrates what happens. So you see, I'm initiating the flux with a small lift force. And you see that the particles start to fly. And what you watch is that some particles, the upper ones, yes, you can watch where they go. I took a very small value of velocity so that you can watch what happens. If I take a high one, they go too fast. You can follow a single particle, and what you see is that if you follow a single particle from one side to the next, yeah, they will come down, this one or that one, they come down at some point, and will collide within the particle in the bed and go up again. So the particles that are on top, when they collide with the particle which is below, they tend to go up again. And so what happens is that these particles nearly never touch ground again. They can have 40 collisions in the air, always jumping up and up and up and never coming down. And of course, the particles that live in these upper regions, they are extremely efficient for the central flux because they are fast, yes? They're very fast, and they are just never coming down, and so they are important, yes.
Normally, we can see a larger particle. So
it's
polydispersed.
This was polydispersed. I said we always use Gaussian distribution with a variance of 15%. Yes, it's polydispersed.
Not
polydispersed. Gaussian. Mm-hmm. So this is the image which we find. I mean, we studied, of course, now in detail, the trajectories of particles. We looked at each particle in the air. So we discovered that they exist, what we now call real cytons. I mean, the word cytons and leptons was coined by Bruno Andreotti. But now we have retaken these words. Really? Yes? No, you don't believe
it?
It's much older.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Well, I...
It's a friend of Bruno Andreotti.
I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't know that. So thank you for telling me. Anyway, so this is what I would now call a real cyton, is this yellow. I'm showing you here, this is not an artist view. This is a real, taking a real particle trajectories from a simulation, 3D. So these are, this is one example taken out of our simulation. And you see this yellow particle collides and collides with other particles which are in the bed, which we call the soft bed. This is a term that has also been coming from in the literature already. So we have the red particles, which are like classical particles jumping, and then this yellow particle, which still never touches ground, because it always tries to come down, it finds another particle below, on which it will jump and come up again.
As every collision, it's as likely to go up as it is down. And it seems you've taken a trajectory that's always taking an upward path. So you have about 10 collisions there.
Well, typically, when two particles come, one is from below and one is above,
yeah,
then the one above would go up again.
Typically,
because it's above already, so it will keep like this.
Okay.
So there isn't, of course, a relation that is, and there's not that by chance that it always goes up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is what we discovered now happens due to the collisions in midair. which increases the flux so importantly. So this is another image of real trajectories as we find them. This is the bottom ones, which you call the top bed, and these are the saltos. Okay, now we can study. This is obtained at a specific value of theta. We obtained now, we measured the different types of particles. We looked at the movie, if you want, at the simulation, and we found out which are the particles that jump all the time, the yellow ones, which are the ones that are in the soft bed, which touch the ground, and which are the ones that never leave the ground, because we saw that there's also some transport on the ground of particles which are just moving in sheet flow. So we can see now how this depends on the Shields number, and what you see is that the effect becomes very dramatic when you come to very high Shields numbers. So maybe this is also a little bit what happens in sandstorms. Okay, so that's the image. And this is now also an image of one of our flashes. So typically what happens when the cyclone finally hits the ground, you then produce a huge flash, and you see that there are particles that move, and then the particles that are injected, etc. Good. Now, we studied the phenomenon in more with a lot of details, and Jim was very helpful. We had a long exchange with Jim on this. So we studied the granular temperature, the function of height, and the flux is function of height for all these different parameters. So what you see is the granular temperature for the elastic, the purely elastic collisions, is huge. So it's a very hot gas, and while the flux is not as large as for the black curve, which is the one with dissipation. So you see, it is advantageous to not to be too hot, like the red one, but then somehow there's another effect coming in. What is it what makes the dissipation? What is the role of dissipation? And there we come back to the classical dry granular flow, which says that if you have dissipative particles, then they tend to align. So the relative velocities are reduced. Each time they collide, the component of the velocities, the relative velocities, which is perpendicular to their motion, is reduced, while the component of the velocities that is parallel to their motion, that is common, yes, is not reduced. So that the tendency is that particles that have dissipative collisions tend to flow on at the end on parallel trajectories. This is what is the effect of dissipation. And this is what I'm showing you here now. So we studied various indicators for this alignment of particle trajectories. So one of them is the angle variation with respect to the wind velocity. So if the particles, of course, have a random motion, but of course they have a strong tendency to flow in the x direction, the wind direction. And you can ask, what is the angle of the trajectory as respect to the wind direction? And this here is this angle alpha. And so we can look at the variance of the angle with respect to wind direction. And this is what is plotted here in this diagram. So this is A, a function of height. And the black curve is what happens for the dissipative case. And the red curve is what happens for the elastic case. And so you see that the alignment is smaller. For the elastic case, correct? Alignment to this is no. Alignment is stronger. Sorry, alignment is stronger for the elastic, for the inelastic case. And here, no, this sorry, I'm sorry. This is wrong. So here I'm here. This is a sigma. Sigma is function of height, and you see that the dashed one is the elastic curve. So here the variance is larger if you have elastic curve, and it's smaller if you have the inelastic one. So it means there's more alignment when you have dissipation. And the other indicator we studied is the ratio of the temperature in the direction, in the vertical direction, and the temperature in the horizontal direction. So this we studied here for also the elastic and the inelastic case, and you see that if in the elastic case, this relative temperature is larger, which means that there is more vertical fluctuation compared to the horizontal one than in the elastic case, in the inelastic case. So all these things show that if you have elasticity, the trajectories are more aligned. And if they are more aligned, of course, then they are more, that they will have, of course, more effect on this, they contribute more to the flux.
Yes. Could one think that the net effect of this is that when they're elastic, they can extract more, they transmit more stress down to the ground, so they're taking more of the horizontal stress, and that's why the flux is lower.
Well, what makes up the flux is only the horizontal component, not the vertical one. The flux is the transport in wind direction. So essentially what happens vertically is only noise. It doesn't help.
It removes more momentum from the wind. If the particles are moving more vertically, they're removing more momentum from the wind field. They're transmitting, they're taking more stress out, so therefore it reduces the horizontal flux.
Well, the stress they take out is only respect to the relative horizontal velocities.
Oh no, but it's being transmitted by the particles as well.
You cannot transform vertical momentum into horizontal one.
When you hit the bed.
When you hit the bed,
So if they have a higher, they're transferring more momentum to the bed through the particle collisions.
The vertical momentum will keep particles up and allow the wind to work on them.
Yes, exactly. The more they are up, but of course the more they are up, the more they will also contribute to the flux. Yes, exactly. Okay, finally, I shall hear the...
Hans, maybe I should point out that you're beginning to compete with lunch.
Oh, sorry. So
we
I should
let our speakers go until they collapse.
Not a good idea. So I will be rather fast now. We just give me like five minutes. Five minutes. So this is another image showing now the distinction between cytons and non-cytons. This is the curve with collisions, and this is the curve without collisions, of the maximum height distribution. So the distribution of how many particles have a certain maximum height. So every particle, we study every trajectory and look at the maximum height it reaches, and then we see that the case with collisions, this distribution has two slopes. One that corresponds to the one is a superposition of two slopes. One that corresponds to the one without collisions, which is like the soft bed, and another one, which has, of course, much higher heights, which corresponds to the cytons. So you can say that if you have collisions, you have on top of the classical soft bed, you have the cytons, which have a different kind of distribution concerning their maximum height. Okay, good. So that then of course, I have tons of more detailed discussion about the concentration profile, velocity, blah, blah. We studied this in detail, discussed a lot with Jim about that. I will jump over this and give you a lot of details about temperature. We come now to the last chapter, which I promised to you, which are now the intermittent time fluctuations of turbulence. So this is something we did now together with Kel. We looked in this regime between, I told you that you have this intermittent flow. What happens? And so what we find is, this is the wind channel. I'm guessing Kel is going to talk to you about that. So what we find is that there exists intermittent burst. This is first just the velocity of the wind in the wind channel. These are the typical fluctuations of the wind in the wind channel. So the wind channel is a real turbulent flow, not like my steady state. So you have here really a lively behavior. This is how you gauge the wind velocity as function of the frequency of your fan that pushes the wind in the channel. So, okay. Now I show you a movie of the experiment of Kel. So you see it was happening nothing, and suddenly you get a burst. You get some kind of transport, and after some time it becomes zero again. And then sometimes it starts again. And so you have, in this intermediate regime, you have intermittent flow of sand. And this you can study now. This was done by my student, Marcus Vitus, in a lot of detail. So he looked at the size. This is now a typical experimental sequence of the flux, a function of time. And now you can study the size of the burst, that means that integrate all the mass that flows in one burst by looking at the pixels that you have in a movie. And you can also study the size of the inter-burst time delays. And this is both of this. This is the size of the burst, and this is the distribution of the inter-delay time of the burst. And this here now is the next thing is what happens. And this is about the wind velocity. And now this is what happens when you change in the experiment the U star. You have a certain U star which is above the threshold, and then you go below the threshold, and you go up again, so you can really control very well the position of the threshold. And you find, now this is, I showed you, this is now image. You find that indeed these data, the red one and the black one, are experimental data. And you see that indeed it seems that there is a jump.
Honestly, I cannot see any jump in the data.
Yeah.
I can see the jump in your eyes. Honestly, I see not a bit of a jump in the data.
Rob, you seem to be a difference of opinion.
It's a miracle point of view.
Yeah.
Kind of that one.
Okay, so this is like maybe wishful. Yeah.
I've been wishful.
Yeah. So at least we then did simulations to try to simulate this phenomenon and included now the intrinsic time fluctuations by the, I don't know if you know this work, is it by Reynolds? You need to reproduce two things. You need to produce the right distribution of accelerations and you need to reproduce the correlations in the acceleration and in the velocity. And for that, this is rather complicated. Of course, I'm not an expert either in this. You can solve these three coupled stochastic differential equations that give you a force, a stochastic force, that you apply now on the particles, giving these particles now the time-independent, force that you're supposed to get from the turbulent field. Yeah? Okay, so we implemented this, just taking it from the work of Reynolds. And here you see now a simulation of what happens in this condition. So I should put this music off. This is stupid. So you see that it from nothing starts slowly, and you can see that in the air, for instance, this particle will have a kink in the air. You see, because of this fluctuating time, fluctuating velocity field in time.
So this is not driven by the model of the turbulent fluctuation.
This is the same one as before, but now we add to this velocity this extra force. And so you can see that there is some kind of stochastic motion in there. Yeah.
So you earlier showed a deterministic lift force based on velocity difference square.
Yes.
Now, in addition to that, you add a fluctuating force.
Yes, exactly. Yes. In addition to the all the forces that add to the particles, I add another force, which is given by this stochastic, which I solve by this equation.
Langevin type equation.
Kind of. Yeah.
So I think the magnitude of the random fluctuation.
This. There's some prefactors in all this, which are related to the Reynolds number.
Reynolds number.
The lambda, R lambda, or you can also
get it.
Yeah. So this is all a self-consistent piece of work where you just get it made a module which we add, so I'm not touching more than just copying what Reynolds did. Yes? And so what you can see from this movie at the end is one thing is that particles at some position, they hit here and then they eject some particles there. I don't know if this is already over, but I don't want to hedge you from lunch, so. Anyway, good. And so this is what you've seen. So these data are the ones that we obtain now from the numerical simulation. And the green data are the ones you see now. The numerical simulation is much less precise, has much more noise than the real data, because the noise of the real data comes from the time fluctuations of the real field. And now if we add ourselves time fluctuations, then we get a lot of noise in our data too. So That's our problem. And as I said, this is maybe stupid. Yeah. Anyway, so what we were able is to reproduce some stuff. And then what we are doing now is to try to include electrical charges. This is future work. And another future work is to study what happens underwater. So we are using some experiment on the water, which you already have seen this before. These are kind of barcodes underwater. So here you have, of course, several processes acting, not just only saltation, but you have also a lot of creep flow and suspension. So all these things come together. So here's all these things to do together. So summarizing, there are many things to be done, including the full 3D simulation, which is not done with the DNS or so. This is certainly very difficult. Then, as I said, some work in water, some work in electric charges, changing the shapes of the grains, including the heuristic boundary layers, including rotations of the grains, and so on and so on. Thank you very much. Very interesting.
Any final questions?
I can ask privately.
Okay, well, no, that's fine. Please.
I was wondering, that one diagram you showed the relative distribution of the different transport modes, the contribution of the transport modes, and I was wondering whether if you have very low Shields numbers, shouldn't you then get almost exclusively transport by rotation? And then when you go to higher Shields numbers, then you start getting contributions from saltation, and then eventually suspension.
Well, you know, the reptation requires rather high Shields numbers. I don't know if the order that you say is really realistic. You see, I mean, you read the require the this. I don't. I mean, suspension also requires doesn't if the particles are small enough, it can do it at small Shields numbers too. So I think that the difference between the different mechanism is not so much a question of the loss of the wind, but of the size of the grains, more.
I meant, if you have, for a given particle size,
yes,
it takes more to get a particle lifted up into saltation rather than just move it over its neighbor.
The strong creep effect we have here is actually mediated by the impact of the saltation particles. This is why you see the most of the flow which you see on the bottom is not coming from the wind or because the wind is very, very weak at the boundary itself.
This may be a question of definition also. Yeah, I mean, one can define the reptating particles as those that are pushed out of the bait in the splash and that do not themselves saltate and excite another splash. That's maybe just a question of
my intuition is that if I just imagine I have a fixed particle size. And then I start turning on the wind slowly.
Yeah, then you have a small saltation length. That's true. Yeah. But you would call them saltating particles, although they just hop on the ground.
Just if they go over.
Yeah, we're in a discussion phase here. So,
I want to say, so what happens is, except for the very last part where you are adding stochastic forces, in the earlier part, what's not there is vertical velocity fluctuations and particle concentration fluctuations, which can provide in a vertical flux of net vertical flux of particles without any collisions, just by turbulent fluctuations.
Mm-hmm.
And for very small particles, that could be a contributing factor, and that's what one would think of as being particles taken deep into suspension. Even in a dilute sense, it can lift far up. And that would probably keep the dust particles.
Yes,
dust
so that means that
up.
Suspension can occur even at very low Shields numbers.
These collisional mechanisms are providing the energy for the particles to lift from the bed, but once they are sufficiently up, just the turbulent fluctuation, the correlation between
vertical velocity fluctuations and the particle concentration is sufficient to keep the particles diffused, effectively diffuse upwards and stay effectively in suspension and get balanced by the settling flux. But what most of what you're showing very interesting stuff is how that mechanism of vertical flux is provided by collisions with the ground as well as internal collisions inside is also a good mechanism to keep in the near bed region a layer of suspended particles flowing.
Do you want to comment on the role of turbulent velocity fluctuations in the phenomena? I mean, they're not included in the simulation.
At the very
end, I showed the end of this effect.
I think there are, let's say, stronger correlations that are present, especially far from the bed, that play a role in maintaining the particles above the bed. So I think you're missing an effect that is not important so near the bed, but far from the bed, as the turbulent.
You say the dodge eddies or so.
Yeah, the eddies become larger, this type of pure turbulence by the turbulent velocity fluctuations becomes important.
Yeah, it was very interesting that you said that this is a layer of particle going happens in a narrow window of particle size. That may play very well is that in this window, the V prime, C prime kind of mechanism is not dominant. So most of the vertical flux is only through collisional mechanisms.
It's not important near the bed.
So therefore, clearly in that movie you showed, you just had a layer of particles going, but nothing really escaping far out. But for finer particles, you could have turbulent fluctuation playing a bigger role in keeping it.
But as you remember, my talk was called Simulating Saltation, and so I exclude
with regard to that, I think these Langevin equations, if you keep the right turbulence statistics in the equation, they should be able to reproduce all of the effects.
In principle, I agree.
Yes, you can put that in. But my question is, I think I'd have a lot of confidence in the very nice results in the when these things are saturated and they're moving high from the boundary, but there's so many assumptions in these sort of models for the turbulence statistics right at the boundary. So in this, whether it actually starts or not, and what about this jump? I mean, I wouldn't have much confidence in that. So I think once it starts going and the particles are up and hitting the bed, that seems fine. But this near bed region seems
hard
to do.
Yes, but you
see,
what gives me confidence is that if I take a completely random approach, I just randomly choose particles, which is very simplistic, I get essentially the same result than if I take more complex ones. So the complexity that you allude to, and which is correct, maybe not in detail so important for what it means. Just
not for the not when you've got a large flux, but right at the transition point, I would be suspicious. Mm. But
yeah, maybe. I mean, the difference between what you say and the just random process are some correlations in where and when you lift particles.
Yeah.
And the question is this correlation really mattering when it comes to a statistical flux? This is not so clear. After all, you average over long times and so on, long spaces.
So with your model, you compare it just to measurements of sediment flux, which is sort of the most forgiving of the laboratory measurements to compare it with. You also compare predicted versus measured sediment concentrations and sediment grain velocities, just to see how the model's doing.
I mean, we don't have to compare it more just fluxes, but not concentration profile.
Yeah, because that data exists, right?
Yes,
so you could actually get a much better sense of how it works.
It doesn't exist at many of the high Shields parameters, though, that Hans was.
Right, but you could run it at.
Just following the Ramos equations. I'm not quite sure whether they are for isotropic turbulence.
Yes.
But then you have strongly inhomogeneous turbulence, why it's immediate turbulence.
It probably will give you a good starting point, but there are a lot of questions in long-term models in spatio-temporal correlations that go into these models. So I agree with what you're saying.
I agree that, of course, you come close to the wall, so then this model is not anymore.
And Hanratty and Ilya Polis, there are people who have extended these kind of Langevin models to inhomogeneous problems with vertical distance as a parameter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But then here what happens is that your buoyancy plays a role, and clearly the suspended particles change your mean flow, so there is no reason why they will not change their turbulent length scales and time scales.
Can I ask one more question related to Jim's? Did you run the saltation simulation to saturation with the Langevin forces on the particles?
Yes.
So then you did incorporate turbulent suspension.
It should be in, yes. But of course, the particles are so heavy that they don't stay much up there. Yeah. Principally, yes. I mean, the Reynolds model should reproduce long correlations too.
We should make an announcement about the group dinner tonight.
Group dinner.
And the group, which is
the Taqueria?
La Superica.
Superica.
And so if you need a ride, or if you can provide a ride, put your name at the social activities page on the wiki space. And if, like Hans, you haven't, you're afraid of the wiki space, send me an email and I will do it for you, okay?
What time are we leaving?
We'll meet at the front entrance here to sort out the rides at 6 p.m. And by the time we get there, it'll probably be like 6:30-ish. But there's always, or typically, there's a line at La Superica. So if it's as cold tonight as it was last night, bring a jacket, because this is not elegant dining. This is what would you call it? A unique Santa Barbara experience.
And tomorrow morning, tomorrow afternoon, there's a barbecue, and for whoever wants to come, we barbecue at 4:30 at the beach. Palita Beach, it's 10 minutes walking, same as 2 weeks ago, and yeah, you should sign up on a wiki as well.
Okay, together now. And Hans, thanks again.